from Hollywood is rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Hello, 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 hello. Yes, you are listening to Rated LGBT Radio, and I'm your host, Rob Watson. Today, we don't have any guest per se. It is just going to be my regular co-host, Brody Levesque, and myself, just us chickens. We are recording today's show on September 11th, 2020. And the reason that is kind of significant is that it is 2011. It is September 11th, 9/11. I wish it was 2011. It is that day every year that we look back, and now we are looking back 19 years since September 11th, 2001. And that was a date that significantly changed our country, our world, and many, many outlooks. And this year it is kind of interesting because that was a major crisis for the country, where this year we have a lot of crises happening across the board. And so we're going to look at the reaction to September 11, 2001, and look at what's happened since then, and look at the reaction to crisis in our modern-day world in 2020, when the year itself seems to signify crisis of many colors. And we're also going to be talking about a statistic in that reaction, which is that suicide rates, especially among younger people, are going up. And it is tied into the crises that we're experiencing right now. So we've got a lot to talk about, and like I said, it's just us chickens. So I'm going to bring on the other big chicken, Brody Levesque. Hey, Brody.
Well, thank you. At least I'm not getting the analogy of the big onion. Good afternoon.
Well, that's true. No, we saved that for other people.
We saved that for other people. Okay, all right. That worked. Good afternoon, Rob. Yeah. Hi to all of our listeners. I did a post before I retired for the evening, as it was already September 11th on the East Coast, and it was working into the 11th here on the West Coast. And it was a reflection of that morning. It was a Tuesday morning. It was really sunny and mild for a September day. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, Brody, before we get into 9/11, I want to ask you about a few things that have happened recently just in the news, so we can kind of touch on them before we get into the bigger subject.
Okay.
So this week, Los Angeles Times endorsed Joe Biden for president, seems to be a little bit of an unprecedented move. Tell us what that was all about.
The fact that many of these newspapers, including the Times and even some conservative papers like the Chicago Tribune and others, are leaning towards endorsements of the Biden-Harris ticket is significant. It means that overall, the newspapers themselves are seeing that the country's just moved completely in the wrong direction. There's absolutely no faith whatsoever in Trump, none, zero, zip. It's the relentless attacks on the media, the constant lying, the revelations from my journalistic colleague Bob Woodward's book Rage, which was put out this week, where the first thing of note was the fact that Trump sat there and admitted that he downplayed the virus. In his words, because he didn't want to create a panic yet, back in February, he admitted that he knew that it was an airborne virus and that it was deadly. it's also, you know, the comments and remarks that he made about veterans and serving members of the U.S. military and military members that have been killed. It is the fact that he revealed the existence of a previously classified nuclear weapon, brand new developed nuclear weapon system. It is the never-ending parade of corruption, not just within the White House, but throughout the entire administration. The most recent glaring example being the Postmaster General. It's become a pile-on, and the media, particularly the newspapers and even some of the broadcast media corporations are saying, you know, enough. The outlet that I happen to be an editor for did the rare thing. Normally doesn't the Los Angeles Blade previously in the past has not done endorsements. Neither has our sister publication, the Washington Blade. This year is an exception. We endorsed the Biden-Harris ticket. There are probably those that are saying, well, for the press, who's left-leaning anyway, that's intuitive. But that's actually not true. The press is not left-leaning. That's the messaging of the Trump administration and the Republican Party. They're just an entire pile-on here because there is so much fatigue from one crisis after the other and rolling from one problem to the next. No resolution, no end in sight. The constant parade of negativity, the violence that continues to break out. And, of course, now we have even more crises environmentally caused piling on that. The city of Portland, Oregon, about 2 hours ago was notifying its residents that, guess what, you guys may have to bail because of the wildfires. So it's just all of this, and these papers are sitting there, Rob, and they're saying it's a failure of leadership on his part, bottom line.
Yeah, no. I want to go back to one thing you were talking about in terms of the Woodward book that came out. It's sort of mind-numbing. First of all, he didn't really tell anybody anything new. You know, those who are bothered by Donald Trump, which is a large amount of people, we already knew he knew. I mean, nobody really had to tell us that. It did confirm it, and it confirmed it on tape, which was significant. But it doesn't and this is one of the things I want to ask you about in a few minutes, it doesn't seem to convince anybody who is already pro-Trump. But it creates these mind-numbing situations where his press secretary walks in, talks in front of a room of your peers, journalists, saying you're referencing something he quote unquote allegedly told Bob Woodward, and the journalist said, "Hello, it's on tape." It's like this isn't alleged; it's real. But the Trump administration, with the ilk that they preach to and all the people who crowd at these events and everything else, has, to your point, on the flip side, that this has been so much, so constant, that the people that are need convincing are deaf. I mean, I guess for me, the biggest concern I have is that the polling numbers for Trump in the election have actually gone up this week. What is going
on
there?
We saw in an NBC Marist poll earlier in the week that Trump and Biden were tied 48-48 in terms of overall. In case of likely voters, Trump actually edged the former vice president out by a single point. And that is actually disconcerting. We're seeing polling numbers going up in battleground states such as Michigan, which Trump did win before, Wisconsin again. We're seeing them edge up in traditionally Republican strong holds such as South Carolina, Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, and, of course, Louisiana. And a good deal of that has to do with the divisiveness and the polarity within the American political landscape now. There is more of a push, I think, by the Democrats and by the political strategists away from trying to convince any of the core base or any of the core Republicans to support the president, because that's flat out not going to happen. What I think they're targeting now are literally the nearly 50% of all the voters that sat 2016 out. And that would be your independents and your moderate Republicans, which, believe it or not, still exist. These are the people that need to be convinced that it is critical to get to the polls to vote. Complicating, however, this effort is the overlay of not only just the pandemic itself, but what it's done to the voting infrastructure, which Trump has capitalized on with his relentless attacks on mail-in balloting and the constant drumming of the fact that he sees it as fraudulent. Yesterday, in an interview with my colleagues at NBC News, the Secretary of State of Michigan pointed out that because they aren't getting the funds from Congress to shore up what's going to be needed to make the voting process as smooth as possible, that they're just going to have to stumble through it now. What cripples them is the fact that you have not only just a dysfunctional post office, but a broken one. So it complicates, as the Secretary of State told NBC News, the overall issue. And Michigan is not alone in that regard. We're finding this in other places as well. The thing that really probably doesn't help above and beyond anything else is when you have the President of the United States screaming at the top of his lungs, fear-mongering. He did it again today in rallies in Pennsylvania. He's painting a very dark vision of Joe Biden's America, but the whole thing is, Rob, it's all based on fallacy, lies, deceptions, and quite frankly, just almost a paranoia, if you will. The baseline problem is that the Democrats are going to have to get the independents and the Republican voters that are moderate, that are completely disenchanted with Trump and his nonsense, to basically break free from party voting and going into voting for the Biden-Harris ticket. The other part of this is that it's also going to be very much a down ballot issue, particularly in some critical senatorial races, such as South Carolina, where Lindsey Graham is running a pretty close race, and of course other places like Arizona, where Mark Kelly is running a close race, and even Mitch McConnell, who's looking like he's out ahead of his Democratic challenger, but that could change. So all of these facts put together give you kind of the overlay for what we're seeing right now. This is indeed. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, Trump is hammering in on his law and order, and part of his fear mongering is specifically mm-hmm. on the protests. And
yes.
Some of the places where those are the most heavy are the states that are the battleground that you mentioned. Are those protests hurting? Because let's face it, voters vote selfishly. They vote from their own little world. And a lot of what is not seeming to resonate is the Trump scandals. They've become numb to it. We're sitting in various crises. They're seeing, rioting in the streets that they would rather not have going on there. So is that what is – and we're talking not the whole population itself, but that middle ground of people who, to me, are kind of a mystery anyway. Because somebody who's sitting there who is, not quite sure whether they're going to vote for Trump or not, quite frankly, is a mystery to me. I don't know why somebody would be in that level of potential confusion, but they're obviously there. And if they're there and they're seeing all this rioting and and being persuaded that it's violent, is his message working?
I think the reason his messaging is working is because there is a sense of complacency with the American voting public, and that has been a long problem. This is not just a new thing. This stretches back almost to the you know, middle of the 1820s, 1830s. It literally is complacency. The voters, I think, in some cases, just throw their hands up in the air and go, well, you know, what can I do about it? And that's a very dangerous place for a voter to be, framing the context of, you know, of this entire political spectrum. You can't afford to take that position. There are too many, however, that do. The other thing that I think more recently has been the crafting of the message rather successfully since just towards the end of the Reagan administration, but in particular about the time Newt Gingrich launched the Contract for America and a Republican takeover in the midterms in 1994. That was establishing the groundwork for what later occurred. The Democrats have not been able to counter that kind of, you know, negative messaging. If you look at Republican Party rule, the Republicans have been in power since Reagan longer than the Democrats have. The Democrats had 16 years. They had Bill Clinton and they had Barack Obama. Both of those presidencies, okay, were under constant siege and under constant attack. The Obama administration got hemmed in because of absolute racism and intolerance from the Republicans. There's no polite way of putting it, right down to questioning whether or not he was even born American, which was where Trump came out of that grouping. You look at Bill Clinton, and, you know, here's the situation where it developed into the impeachment of Bill Clinton. So you're bookending 16 years of Democratic rule with Republican and conservatism and a way of thought. There have been some victories in social issues along the way, LGBTQI rights, of course, but I would also note that most of those were won in court battles. So, you know, it's really kind of a scary thing. Trump is able to be Trump, not just only because of the complacency of the voters, but because the groundwork was laid mostly in the midterms of 94 with the first Republican takeover of the House and the Senate. That's really where it started. And then it was bolstered by the extremism of the members of George W. Bush's cabinet and his government, which were then in turn exasperated by what happened 19 years ago this date. So it's just kind of this pile-on. So Trump's messaging of law and order is going to partially resonate with some of those people. And that they're not looking through the forest to see the single tree of reality is really what the problem is here. And then they're not convinced enough that their vote really matters. The younger people, the generations that are your sons, up to, you know, some of the young people that you and I both know that are in their mid-20s, that spectrum right there is where a lot of change will probably occur, and a lot of what's being driven for change, brought about by things such as, you know, the school shooting issues and the Black Lives Matter. So there is an awakening. But the question becomes, is there awakening enough to get the people into the ballot box to get them to change things? And then the most difficult aspect of it all, if anything, a further complication, is in fact this COVID crisis of pandemic over the overlay. So it's kind of like a pile on. Fair answer to your
question.
No, it's
definitely, it's definitely a pile on. I'm not convinced that it's complacency, at least not complacency in that people are, middle America are not really caring or not really, you know, participating in the system and just, kind of doing something rote. I think that part of the behavior there is that everything you described in terms of this overwhelmingness of problems, and then people are looking at their own lives where they're struggling themselves. And it's they're being asked to tackle everything from systematic racism to climate change to this virus to all these things that are way out of their control, and they're just trying to figure out how they're going to pay their mortgage or they're going to pay their rent or if they're going to have a job. And Trump, even though the economy is bad right now, it's like nobody – he did the PR to get people to believe that the good economy that was prior to – and I'm going to put quotes, unquotes, good economy prior to the virus hitting was because of him, which it wasn't. And, and it wasn't even all that good of an economy when you look at it in terms of the existence in the middle class. But I think there is going to be an effect if Biden doesn't come out with more proactive solutions and vision on how to solve people's lives, that is going to hurt him. Because right now we're sitting in a, look what a big train wreck Trump is. Isn't it awful? And hoping that people just think anything better is better than that. And I don't know, this guy is greasier than hell, and nothing sticks to him. And, it's – so that scares me. I mean, it scares me that another 4 years of Donald Trump scares me. And I think something has got to change in giving people hope. It's not enough just to say hope. They've got to actually be able to taste it with Joe Biden. And I think he's a little invisible right now.
He had an interview yesterday with my colleague, Jake Tapper from CNN. And they sat down in Michigan where he was campaigning at that moment. And they talked about the revelations coming out of the 18 hours of recording that, went into Bob's book. And then they also talked a little bit about some of the statements and things that, Trump has made. And, the reactions from Biden were very much heartfelt and very much, keeping in character, with the way that, Joe Biden is. The problem is going to be, again, messaging. Now, interestingly enough, his vice presidential running mate candidate, Senator Kamala Harris of California, is staying very much on messaging and putting that out there. I think Biden is finding himself in a difficult place because not only is he the candidate for the Democratic nomination, but he's also finding himself thrust into the role, of comforter, because people just need that because they haven't gotten it from Trump. I mean, all they've gotten from Trump has just been callous, I don't even want to go there. But the question is Joe's character enough? Are the Americans going to trust him from a policy point of view in order to make the significant changes where their lives will be directly impacted? A lot of that right now is revolving around two significant issues. Number one, of course, being this virus. That if you talk to most voters, and I talk to our polling people probably at least every couple of days, the number one thing that we keep hearing back is, virus, economy, what am I going to do? In a kind of a micro study of that, in the city of West Hollywood, California, which is the heart of the LGBTQI community for many years in Los Angeles, they are now losing businesses left and right, including They just lost three major nightclubs and bars, which were basically anchors for the community there. And it was all because of this crisis. Even if they're able to come out the other end, you know, there's nothing to stop the hemorrhaging in terms of not enough cash flow to pay the current rent plus the back rent. So Biden is going to have to look at things just like that. And governments, even Newsom has acknowledged, the governor of California has acknowledged, the government's going to have to play a much, much greater role. Without that role, you know, it's going to be an epic depression, probably even blowing past, you know, the historic downs of the Great Depression of the 1930s. And that really becomes a critical thing. You know, do you buy into Trump's Kool-Aid that, you know, this is what's going to get better and we'll take care of this when you've got the Senate locked up fighting with the House on whether or not they'll deliver more stimulus money to the American, you know, people? In the meantime, the bar owner sitting there in West Hollywood is going, but I had to close my doors. I'm done. You know,
right.
That's it.
Right.
37 years. I'm finished. What are you going to do? And this now suddenly trickles into households, you know?
No, absolutely it does, because one of the big issues with the recovery attempt is the recovery attempts have all been on the front end. In other words, you know, it's been getting people some money to buy some food. You know, it's given them the ability to delay rent or mortgage but not forgive it, meaning the people on the front end have to come up with that money at some point somehow. And the people who've been protected have been the ones at the top, because they're not taking a hit. They're not, you know, the banks have not said, the mortgage holders, the landlords have not said, oh, okay, we're just going to figure we're going to get less money, which will happen because people will not be able to pay it. The money won't be there to pay that. So you will have bankruptcies. You will have people being evicted eventually. I mean, and, you know, and nobody is putting into place that reality or a solution to that reality. So it is, you know, something that the cracks in the pipeline of the economy are going to fall apart at some point here. And that is going to be incredibly, incredibly difficult.
Well, and again, the biggest problem for the Democrats right now, okay, is getting some sort of unified, concrete solution or proposal for a solution. But then again, you have one thing standing in the way of this, and that is unless the Democrats are able to control all three branches of government, then nothing's going to get done, because all it's going to take is that Senate to stay in Republican hands. And it doesn't matter, you know, what the Democrats in the House do. It doesn't matter what President Biden, if he becomes president, does. If you can't get anything through the Senate and you have the same kind of problems that we saw McConnell gave the Obama's administration, what people aren't, I think, truly understanding is that the boil over factor is already there with the public. They've had enough. They're not going to take another 4 years, even with a Biden White House, okay, of inactivity caused by obstruction. There's too much at stake. Sooner or later, that's going to spill over. And if that does in fact happen, okay, it's going to make what happened in Kenosha, Portland, Oregon, Chicago, and some of these other American cities look like a block party. And that's really what the real fear is. And this isn't me fear-mongering. This is me standing very calmly, very matter-of-factly, you know, in conjunction with a lot of information that we've been given from people within the American government, that this is a fully anticipated scenario. This is it. This is exactly the point that the American Republic has found itself at. And that's not really a really good place to go. This goes beyond, you know, a breaking point. So this is why this election becomes even more critical. It's you know, how do you maintain the tenets, you know, of a democracy, and how do you maintain, you know, a system where everybody, you know, works within it if nothing happens? Inactivity sooner or later is going to run right up against human nature. And then that's really what this boils down to. But the problem with it for the United States is you must, absolutely must, factor in the extremist levels that have occurred both on the left and the right, okay, because it's gotten really, really seriously ugly, okay? So it's one of those things where Biden's got to consider this. Trump doesn't care. Trump's whole thing is law and order. Trump is like, I mean, the Trump administration comes up with all sorts of things, you know, to expand even an authoritarian state. You know, a little micro example was that now the administration's Homeland Security people have issued a proposal to expand DNA and biometric data collection, okay, of immigrants to include American citizens who are sponsoring them. Now, the ACLU, of course, is raising all sorts of red flags.
Right.
You know, kind of the oh, my God thing. But that's where their mindset is. They don't have a problem with that. And that's really where...
Well, no, yeah,
gets,
of course they don't.
You know.
And that again, goes to... Here's the core of the problem. It's what you're describing is a symptom. It's not the problem. The problem is that the country isn't a democracy. It is ruled by a few. It is being led by the states with lesser populations than the urban centers. And the systems, including the Senate and the Electoral College, support that. So the election is won by these states that are these quote-unquote swing states, which are not the most populous states. And they, you know, it's like everybody, or in the past election, people were crediting Trump because he, you know, played the election right so that he got the votes of the Electoral College, where Clinton got the popular vote by millions. And that if Trump wins again, that will be the case. He will not win the popular vote. He won't even come close to it. And again, he will be a president that is not elected by a democracy. And the Senate, to your point, of the part of the government that is obstructionist, is run by senators from these less populous states. And the states that are represented by senators who are in front of the majority of the population are like 10 senators out of 50 or out of 100, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's like, it is, you know, the formula that was constructed for this representative government is breaking down because population is not growing in a proportionate way as was originally part of the original vision. And the original vision was already flawed because it was all based on white male property owners as being
sure.
the citizens.
So,
yeah. You know, it's like we've got, you know, and Trump plays to that strategy because everything you're talking about is speaking to concerns of the vast population in an urban center. He isn't, you know, he isn't scaring the people that are actually swaying the election. Because they don't care if people don't, you know, their DNA doesn't match up right. These guys have got the you know, protected DNA, if you will. You know, it's so, I mean, it's there is a huge, huge core issue that nobody is ready to address at this point.
Now, the problem is we're also seeing a lack of it being addressed more strongly and more urgently by the Biden campaign, and that in and of itself is very problematic.
Yeah, exactly.
Man.
Because it's something that's been said long before is that Biden cannot run based on just being not Trump. He can't do that. And unfortunately, he has been doing that. He did that in the primaries where he essentially just was not Sanders. And so, you know, and if it wasn't for the African-American vote coming out from in South Carolina, he probably would have gone down because he hadn't done that. And, you know, it's so I don't know. This is hard. And, you know, those of us who care have got to figure out a strategy. And I'm hopeful that the Biden Harris campaign gets with it and gets, you know, some stronger firepower as if they weren't running against Trump, you know, and give vision. I mean, Obama won the first time because he excited people. He gave people vision. And he probably would have achieved that vision, to your point, if he wasn't obstructed by a Senate that was out to do nothing but stop him. You know, and we've got to turn this around. We absolutely have to. Brody, I want to shift gears here, though, to one of the reactions to what is going on, and that is the rising suicide level. I mean, you made reference to the fear that, you know, this is going to erupt with the extremist factions, you know, being violent in the streets. And violence is already happening in the private. Talk to us about that.
The Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta published a study based on some surveying they had done in June. And what they were looking at specifically was how the COVID pandemic and crisis was affecting the population base. And they came across a rather jarring statistic that really wasn't one that you would have thought of. 26% of adults between 18 to 24 have considered suicide. And according to the researchers with the CDC, that number is a direct result of a significant role that it has played. Rashawn Lane, who is head of the CDC's COVID-19 response team, said this in an emailed statement to me. Mental health conditions are disproportionately affecting specific populations, especially young adults. You know, that's one of the things that it just kind of, you look at that and you go, but wait, why would they be in that kind of a group? And a lot of the responses to the survey and a lot of it was because, quite frankly, they saw no hope. They didn't see, you know, the end of it. They were taking such a hard apocalyptic view, if you will. You know, in our own LGBTQI community, we've long held that bullying and ostracization and the damages inflicted by organized religion, especially the far right Christian groups and things like that, have long been a contributing factor to the high and disproportionate amount of suicides in our own community, particularly with our trans youth. But now here you have a study that says, well, you know, as taken as a whole, we have a problem. And it really kind of distills down to a lack of hope. You know, they don't see coming out the other side. What they see is an ineffective response to the crisis, not just by the Trump administration, but globally. They are watching a social upheaval that has, quite frankly, not been seen in this country since the days of the Vietnam War protests and the civil rights marches and that movement of that era, which to them was in history books, quite frankly. So they have no firsthand experience, and then not having that sense of hope and just bereft of seeing any changes. You know, jobs are going away, employers are going away. All these things are going away. You know, where does it end? Where does it stop? Where's the benefit? And that really just triggers a lot of, you know, this depressive state. And again, it, in part because there aren't any readily identifiable solutions to a lot of the questions that are being asked.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, it is difficult, and it is kind of characteristic of the crises that we are facing now versus, for example, when the subjects we're talking about today is 9/11, the original 9/11, the 9/11, 2001. And, you know, that wasn't our collective reaction to that depression and futileness and everything else that happened after that. Brody, you started at the top of the show to talk about your experience that day. Tell us a little bit about what that was like.
I was substituting for a reporter who had taken leave of absence. And so it was a new beat for me. And I'd only been to the Pentagon a few times to cover briefings. That particular morning, I checked in at our office, and then I wandered over to the subway at Gallery Place and rode over to the Pentagon. And in those days, you could get off the train and literally enter the building directly from the subway station, and you had to pass the security and show them your, you know, badges and all that. And then it lets you off in an area that we call a concourse, which is basically a little commercial shopping district, if you will, in the bottom of the building. And I grabbed a cup of coffee and grabbed a dash or something, and then I headed for the press area. And when I got in there, virtually everybody was clustered around television sets. And, I this was pre-smartphones, or, you know, iPhones didn't exist in 2001. And so there was no alerts and no, you know, didn't know, right? And, I was just shocked because Tower 1 was on fire. There's all this black smoke. And then suddenly, about not even a couple minutes after I arrived in the room, suddenly all this smoke started pouring out of Tower 2. And the camera that was on it was at the angle away. So we didn't at first understand that a second plane had blown into the other tower. And then suddenly one of the announcers on the ground, yes, there was another plane, oh my God. And we're watching this, not even 20 minutes later, the entire building I was in shook. My first thought was, my God, that was an earthquake. That's how strong it was. And then seconds after that, every bloody alarm in the building went off, and people started running and screaming. And, you know, we tore out, we went out. I went out the river entrance and with a bunch of others, and we kind of ran around the building. And when we got to the one side of the building that faces the Columbia Pike and part of Arlington Cemetery, there was fire and heat and smoke and a smell that I'll never forget. And then the next 26 hours were just vignettes of everything that happened. It was surreal. As a reporter, you know that you're going to sometimes find yourself in situations that, you know, are extraordinary and extreme. And that morning at the Pentagon, all the way through the day and into the night, until the next day morning when I finally got back to my apartment in Washington. That just vignettes. It's
right.
The ambulances and the people and the trying to get the, you know, the military personnel that were, you know, their uniforms were just covered in blood and torn. And it was just something. It was a war zone. It really literally was a war zone.
Right.
It went beyond catastrophe.
I just want to juxtapose that with my experience that day, because I was set to speak at a convention in San Diego and got up that morning and was watching the news live. And the first plane had hit the building, and it was at that point that was, you know, everybody's reaction was like, wow, what a bizarre freak accident that is. And there was concern about it. It was obviously everybody was paying attention to it because it was a freak. And then as we were watching, and I was watching this live as it happened, the second plane hit. And I did see it go into the building on television. And that was when everyone's alarms were going off that this was not something new. And while you were literally sitting there at the Pentagon, then the report came that the third plane had hit the Pentagon. They switched to that. That was not captured live, at least in this report that I saw. You know, it had already happened at that point. So for me in California, it was sort of bizarre because I really didn't need it, but I had it. I'd gotten a rental car to go from the San Diego airport to the hotel and was coming back to Northern California and called the rental car company to let them know that, guess what? Not flying up, so I'm taking your rental car up north. And as I drove through California, first of all, I drove by the airport where all the planes were grounded, and that was a very surreal thing, looking at those planes, which were no longer just vehicles of transportation, but I now looked at them as potential weapons. But going through, listening to the radio as I drove through every community in California going north, every community was filled with fear, was filled with sort of this feeling like a plane was going to land on them, which didn't happen and wasn't a real threat. But it was this ridiculous calm of repression, of fear, as I moved up north throughout California. And it, all the while watching what was happening back east and the horror and tragedy, because the thing of watching the Twin Towers themselves was watching the footage of all the first responders going in and literally knowing when the towers fell that the people you've been watching for the last hour and a half were still in there and not coming out again. So that was bringing us into a unified experience that we can't shake. I kind of want to switch to the leadership of the country. As you met and know George W. Bush yourself, and I was not a fan. Wasn't a fan, of him during his presidency. But for America, when he stepped forward in that aftermath, everybody fell behind him. And how would you characterize the difference of that leadership of that Republican versus the Republican we have now?
President Bush intuitively knew that the entire country, in fact, the entire globe, would be looking to him to basically gauge reaction. And they needed the signals and the body language that he was giving off, and he gave it. He was assertive. He was strong. To use an way overused term, he was presidential. In the first hours, there was so much confusion, and there was a lot of, terror at what had happened. I was outside in the thick of the, rescue efforts and everything. We all were involved. I didn't see the towers collapse and all of that, or even what was going on with the president until actually later on in that evening when we took a break. We watched his address when it happened. He took charge and he said, we're going to get through this as a country. We're going to take whatever precautions we need. It was surreal because not only were the skies emptied over Washington, but there were military fighter jets on patrol and visibly on patrol, which was just, it was disconcerting. It was the type of patrol that you'd see in a war zone. You contrast the immediacy, and then, you know, the president went to Ground Zero, and he basically told, you know, his Secret Service detail, I'm doing this, I don't care what you think. And, you know, he met with the firefighters and the first responders, and he got on top of that pile of rubble, and, you know, he grabbed that one retired fire guy, and then he grabbed the bullhorn, and, you know, his voice was the voice of all Americans at that point. And the difference between that and the reality star who thinks he's a president, you can't get a greater contrast. Trump is, he's got no empathy. He's just this narcissistic, humorless being that doesn't understand basic empathy, basic humanity. Whereas with Bush, you know, not only that, but he knew and understood the weight of the office, which is something that Biden pointed out to Jake Tapper yesterday. Trump doesn't get it. He can never be a president because he does not understand what it truly means to be presidential. He's got no clue. He has no idea of what the weight of the office is. To him, it's just another opportunity to make money or to promote himself, and that's exactly what it's been with Bush. And there were a lot of things about Bush that, you know, a lot of people have problems with and find execrable. But the one thing that, you know, you have to give the president credit for is that when it came down to this moment in time, he was the glue that held the fabric of the United States and the globe, really, together at that moment.
Yeah.
Because it could have gotten seriously ugly otherwise.
Well, and it's true, very true, and especially in the psyche of the country. But what he did do, what his administration did do, was then to take us and get us into two wars as retribution for that event, which for me, in my opinion, was not good, and was where it may have collected our focus in terms of Iraq was inappropriate. Where Afghanistan is, its appropriateness is at least rationalized, if not debatable. But that was where he took us from that point in time. Juxtaposing that with Trump and the current crisis, Trump in many ways is the crisis himself.
Yeah.
You know, it's like he is, especially in terms of COVID-19, he's the facilitator of the level of crisis behind it. You know, in terms of the environment and climate change, his administration's lack of activity, a lack of initiative to quell, you know, the effects of climate right now are part of the problem. You know, you can't blame it on them, but they're certainly doing nothing to alleviate the environment, and I'm talking about the environment, it's capital E environment, not adjective environment or political or psyche environment, that they're not being part of the solution, which literally makes them the only tangible thing that is part of the crisis itself. It's just, I guess going back to our real discussion is how mm-hmm. much of the American population is clearly identifying him as being the problem.
I think that there is a significant section of the population that is beginning to see it. I think that Had it not been for COVID-19, Trump probably would have been reelected. I think that COVID-19 has put that in doubt. It's not a for certain, but it's definitely very much in doubt. Whereas I would have questioned with no COVID-19 that there would not have been another 4 years of a Trump administration. So I think that the utter total lack of empathy and effective leadership will probably ultimately be his undoing. But the real question is whether Biden, Senator Harris, and more importantly, Democratic leadership, not just on Capitol Hill, but across the United States in these state houses and other places, can turn this around. The Republicans have proven that they have no interest in governing. They only have interest in power. When you have a party that has no interest in governing and its only interest is power, eventually something's got to give. And that's really what it boils down to. The voters are going to have to decide. And it's on a micro level of whether that bridge gets fixed or that pothole gets filled or our kids have safe water to drink or good schools. It really becomes down to that issue at its very core. Do we want to put a party back in office that is only interested in enriching themselves, their buddies, and they don't honestly care about you, and they play kowtow to some pretty bizarre things? Or do you want a party that, while imperfect, at least will stumble through and try to govern? And that's really what this election comes down to. The American people right. have to make a choice, and that's really what the choice is.
Yeah, I think, and I'm going to sum this up because we're running out of time here. I think part of it is we need a leadership team that is visionary, that has some ideas of hope to start to rebuild, not just in practical sense that we need it, but also psychically we need it. Suicide rates are going up. The effects are going deep on the crisis we've been through, and if they don't want this crisis to turn into a deeper malignancy in the American psyche, they need to get it together quickly, and not only to get into office, but to solve this. Because if they do get into office, guess what? These problems are now theirs. And they're not ones they can just point a finger at. There's that they have to solve. Well, with that, we are out of time. Brody, I want to thank you, as always, for your thoughts and insights and everything you do to inform the world and your other hat as a top-notch journalist. I want to thank our listeners. Please do tell your friends, subscribe to our podcast. We will be back here again next week. With more thought-provoking ideas, thoughts, and guests. And with that, for Brody and myself, and Rated LGBT Radio, we will talk to you again then.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio!
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.